You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz, and I'm your host, Angela Tabora, joined by my co-host, Aaron Lim. Right now, we'd like to welcome on the show from The Fight, we have co-directors Elise Steinberg and Eli Dupre, and Dale Ho, who's one of the subjects of the film. So, Elise or Eli, would you like to introduce us to your documentary?
Sure. Thanks so much for having us. And so the film follows ACLU's star lawyers on the ground fighting Trump's attacks on civil liberties. We're with the lawyers around the clocks in their homes, in their strategy sessions, finding clients, getting anonymous tips, and culminating in courtroom showdowns, including one at the Supreme Court, which Dale was involved in. It is a real-life David versus Goliath thriller.
Yeah. And the access in this film is incredible. Can you talk about how that even happened?
Sure. We went to the ACLU after the election and seeing some of our lawyers at work. And we asked Legal Learnt to make the introduction. He's the lawyer you see in the opening scene who's fighting the family separation cases. Mm-hmm. And we explained to the ACLU that we're Verite filmmakers. We want total access. We want to be inside while all the decisions are being made, seeing how they discuss strategy, every aspect of how the cases are put together and fought. And they said, that's great. We love your vision. And there is no way that you are ever going to be allowed
to film.
It's
good to dream. Yeah. It's nice to have goals.
Thanks. We like what you're doing, but you're not going to
yes,
do it.
Yes, yes. Lovely, lovely meeting you. There's the door. So we looked at each other and said, yeah, we can make this work. And then we started the conversation.
Well, okay, so the ACLU has 147 lawsuits against the Trump administration. How did you pick which ones you were going to follow?
Well, these were the most important cases of the last 4 years. You have voting rights, you have abortion rights, you have family separation, you have LGBT rights, and these are the biggest cases. And we were, you know, lucky to be around to film them.
And Dale, of course, we need to bring you into the conversation. Can you talk a little bit about your story and also what it was like to be on that side of the camera?
Yeah, it was a little different from what I normally do, right? You know, I litigate voting rights cases around the country. I speak a lot, in court. But having like a film crew following me around, you know, in elevators, in hotel rooms, mm-hmm. With my family, was a little required. Me to kind of, you know, tune them out a little bit and, you know, be vulnerable in ways that, you know, when I'm presenting publicly in court, I'm not usually that kind of, I'm not usually that accessible emotionally, I guess I'd say.
Mm. Yeah, emotion is the right word for for the storyline. And how did your family feel being part of this film? Because we do follow your story a little more intimately.
Yeah, I think there, you know, my wife was a little reluctant at first, but, you know, when everyone explained the project to them. She was on board for it. It's tough because, you know, this work, fighting for civil rights right now, particularly right now, it's draining. It's really emotional work. And like I said, when I'm in court, you know, it's like the opposite of acting, right? Acting, some people ask, are acting and, you know, like being a courtroom lawyer, are they similar? And in some ways that might be the case, but you know, in court, you don't want to show your vulnerability. You actually don't want to be spontaneous. You want to act like everything that happens is something that you expected to happen, like you're in control at all times. And transitioning from that kind of posture, that kind of public presentation, to just sort of being myself on camera was different.
And watching the film, I felt that this was also, there's maybe another layer to this in terms of just the Trump administration. I mean, that is the through line through the whole story, which is kind of upsetting. I mean, this film really probably wouldn't be made without him being in office. So can you talk a little bit about that and how you handled that? sure. part of the story?
I think, you know, just on a personal note, my mother was also a litigator who fought for immigrant rights. Mm. So the story and the struggles of these lawyers are very familiar to me. And one of the things that I think, you know, we're Verite documentary filmmakers. If you saw Wiener, what we like to do is get in.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
So what we like to do is get inside and show the human story, show what it really looks like to fight these big civil rights cases. So these, so what excited us was not only, you know, showing these heroes, and that's what Dale is.
Totally.
But showing them fighting for our fundamental freedoms, but also doing that while they're wrangling with their children, while they're struggling with the phone charger. And so what you see is, it's something we can all relate to. They fumble, they argue, they're just like, we're all in this together in this struggle. And I think we sort of feel that history is manifest through these struggles. And I think that's something we wanted to get across.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk a little bit more about the filming? Because you're there for all of these moments, did you have a crew on all four of them? Like, the whole time, did you have running gun, like people on call, like, hey, this is happening right now, run to the courthouse, you know,
that's
things
exactly
like that.
That's exactly what we had. It was. I mean, we've never taken on anything sort of this scope. It felt epic.
Yeah.
I mean, this feels like a turning point in history, and we sort of were all hands on deck. So
right.
We were zipping off with Dale to California, to Kansas, with Lee to the border. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you can hear our voices in the film, just asking a question here and there. And you'll notice every time one of our attorneys gets a question, it's from somebody different. And that's because we were scattered across the country. It ran us ragged. It was a real challenge. I mean, it was fun. It was good. But it does feel like we're at the end of a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, it's insane. One of these stories could have been a film in and of itself. You could have broken it down into four separate films. So you definitely aimed high.
Yeah. Well, I think what you see is these lawyers are fighting on multiple fronts. And we really wanted to show the scope of what's happening and what's at stake, of what this fight right now looks like. And I think that was our original idea, was to get inside the ACLU to show these scrappy lawyers doing their thing.
Right, because as someone that's outside of it, you see the headlines, ACLU, ACLU, but you don't know who the people are. Mm-hmm. There's real people that are doing this work every day, and it was very powerful. And thank you for including all the hate mail that they get, mm-hmm. and the voicemails.
The voicemails, yeah.
That's the time we're living in, I guess, yeah.
And that urgency, that sense of urgency definitely comes across in the filmmaking and in the story. And I mean, you get a little emotional, you, yeah. towards the end, are like, if this is my job, if, you know, because it, obviously your job takes you away from your family a lot, you know, there are definitely results to this difficult work. But in the end, you're like, if this is my job, this is the time that I have to do it. This is, yeah. when I need to show up, you know, so it's not even a question of, do I continue this work? It's like, I have to.
That's right. I mean, I grew up, at least, I mean, that's how I feel about it. You know, I grew up wanting to be a civil rights lawyer. I know that sounds weird, maybe to some people, but that's
when I grew up,
this idea in my head.
I wanted
I
to be
know.
A dinosaur, but sure. Yeah, we all have different childhoods.
I didn't know what that actually meant, right? Until even when I was in law school, I didn't even know what it meant to be, you know, a civil rights lawyer. You know, I'm sitting in a class learning about, like, contracts and things like that, you know, law school doesn't actually prepare you for this kind of work. But when I finally got the chance to do it, it felt like coming home. Like, this is what I wanted to do, and it is tough. It's tough on my family a little bit. My wife has to do a lot herself, and I'm so grateful to her for holding down the fort when I'm away from home so frequently. But I sort of feel like there's no choice right now, right? If not now, when? Right? We're in, you know, the toughest fight for civil rights in my lifetime, and we can't stop until this moment passes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you're the director of the Voting Rights Project.
Yeah,
and we're in 2020.
I've heard that.
And you know, there's an election coming up. Can you talk a little bit about how that work is shaping up for this year?
Yeah, I mean, part of what's tricky about being a voting rights lawyer in an election year is you kind of don't know what's going to happen. You just know a lot of stuff is going to happen. And so part of my job, you know, I manage a team of about you know, 12 lawyers, and like part of my job is just making sure that we're ready for the inevitable emergencies that are going to arise over the course of the next 10 months. And you know, I just know we really have our work cut out for us.
Yeah.
I think we need to start a letter writing campaign to counter all these death threats, to thank these lawyers. And
we'll start sending thank you notes.
Yeah, I mean, a fruit basket, you know, yeah. Some muffins every now and then. Like, we need to support these people and give them a face. So thank you guys for doing that.
You know, I will say, you know, we do, in addition to the hate mail, occasionally get just like random little thank you cards. And that actually means a lot.
Mm-hmm. Will you accept a thank you tweet?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Absolutely.
Well, and just really quickly, we have to wrap up here, but my co-host here noticed an Oakland A's something in your office.
Yeah. Are you from the Bay?
I'm from the South Bay, but I grew up rooting for the A's. You know, I'm still a huge A's fan.
We live in San Francisco. Nice.
We knew it.
So,
yeah, we're like, that's some Bay Area vibe.
Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, he has to be from there. I mean, there's really no one that has like an A's pendant. And then you had the three players on your desk. So.
Yeah.
I mean, I was really watching that. Don't worry.
Thank you guys so much for being here. Again, we've been speaking to Elise Steinberg, Eli Dupre, and Dale Ho of The Fight. Watch this documentary. It's amazing, and pay attention.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, here with my co-host from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And sitting across from us is Ron Howard. Ron Howard, who has directed a film called Rebuilding Paradise. And Ron, this is a point where we usually let our filmmaker tell us what the film is about.
Oh.
You start off.
Well, there was a huge fire in Northern California on November 8th of 18. And in the town of Paradise, California, a town that I knew something about because my mother-in-law had lived there, and I have a lot of relatives in Redding, which is not very far away. Mm-hmm. It burned. 95% of it burned. You know, a town of 26,000 people, everyone just scattered. Ultimately, there were 85 fatalities. Mm-hmm. It was you know, a stark tragedy. And it really shook me, because, you know, look, we see these images from all around the world, and then when it hits a little close to home, you really feel it, and that's human nature. And I really felt it, and I began to wonder what that town was going to do now. You know, once the cameras leave, once mm-hmm. it's not in the spotlight, you know, who. Who's going to care? Can it rebuild? What will rebuilding look like? And that word kind of resonated, and we just started talking about Rebuilding Paradise. We went to our documentary group at Imagine Entertainment. I've really fallen in love with working on documentaries, and so I shared it with the team, and they said, let's just send a crew. We sent a crew. Then I joined. Then I kept going back two or three times, and then we took this footage from those early days and weeks to Nat Geo, and we got to make this movie, which is about this community, and the question of whether they can come back and what will it be like for them. And ultimately, I think it sort of underscores, and I think this is a sort of the dramatic surprise in it. And it's logical if you think about it, but it's not necessarily what comes to mind when you see these images. Is this sort of long tail of trauma. Mm-hmm. It's complicated. Mm-hmm. It's getting through the fire and the tragedy. Of course, that's one thing. So it's a character study, and the town's a character. Mm-hmm. And we began following individuals who were staying and digging in and going to try to make it work.
Well, I think you set us up for that at the very beginning of this, because this incredible footage mm-hmm. of people trying to escape the fires and being in the middle of it, and it is harrowing. It is gut-wrenching and the edge of your seat, all those things that people say about that. Yeah. And it sets us up for that process.
It's really, you know, as a filmmaker, And I'm, again, new to documentaries. This is my first Verite documentary. You know, I've done profiles of musicians and Pavarotti and the Beatles and Jay-Z and things like that. I loved it. Really fell in love with the medium. But this is the first one where I no way of knowing what this story was going to be about. You couldn't, this is not about sculpting thematics, you know, like you would in a screenplay. It's about discovering and the answers, finding them. And of course, it's the individuals that we follow who give us some of those answers, but they also pose, you know, other questions. All that said, I think that that opening 10 minutes as put together by our editorial team and worked on for, you know, months and gathered from the townspeople is about as cinematic and harrowing a sequence as I've been involved in.
Well, exactly, and it goes exactly what you're saying, that, you know, we've had a number of these environmental disasters in the last couple of years, but there's a distance to them, mm-hmm. and we feel bad, but what the film does from the outset is go, well, if you were in the center of really hell coming to your home and destroying it, this is what it would be like.
Yeah, it's a really it's a test. It's a very cruel test, and again, there's no, you know, there's no thesis here that I'm trying to prove. It's really letting the community show us what it means, and there are some surprises along the way, and ultimately I wouldn't have known whether it could be about resiliency, but I think it very, very much is. It's not easy. It's not pretty. It's not safe emotionally. It's a real demonstration of that. And I think it does ask a question for viewers. I hope people see it. I think people are going to get, you know, draw different values from seeing the film, based on who they are, what they've experienced, where they live, and so on. But I hope everyone can relate to it, and I kind of hope everyone comes away with the question, if this were to happen to me, and look, it's the reality, it's the new normal, it's happening more and more. It's not just fires, it's all kinds of catastrophes. And if it were to happen, what would I want? What would I hope for from my community, my family, society? What would I need? How would I cope? Am I prepared for that kind of thing? And so I hope if there's any soul searching, it's really that. It's just recognizing that, you know, facing that sort of gauntlet is something that could happen to any of us at any time.
Yeah, and what I wanted to mention was that a few of us here live in the Bay Area and live in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and that week felt like the apocalypse was happening. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't even imagine what was happening in Paradise.
Well, you got a tremendous amount of smoke from the Redding, from the car fire.
Exactly.
And then the campfire. See, right. I have a lot of relatives in Redding. So I first was worried about them, and they were pretty much unscathed, which was great news on a family level. Then I heard about just the smoke and the fallout and the aftermath, and then, you know, the campfire comes along with Paradise, right. And again, mm-hmm. a community that I knew because my mother-in-law had lived there for about 5 years before she passed away. Mm-hmm. Great little town, mm-hmm. and also not a town, not an affluent town. Mm-hmm. There is some affluence there, but there are also a lot of people who are there because it's less expensive. They're hanging on. They're retirement people, one thing that again, it's one of those things that you sort of know if you think about it, but you don't necessarily. It's not front of mind, which is. A catastrophe like this comes along, whether it's a fire or a storm or a death or some other family tragedy or anything, and it really puts into relief, you know, all the frailties, all the weaknesses. Everything gets exacerbated in a really intense way. In this case, you're talking about that for a community of 25,000 plus people.
Right. Well, and I also wanted to quickly jump in on. Your approach to this, as you have done some other documentaries leading up to this, but that working from a narrative standpoint versus working from a documentary standpoint.
Yeah.
And you said, you know, that there's a different kind of joy to it. I think
I'm finding it very exciting. I also really believe it's kind of stimulating and invigorating a new kind of way of looking at the scripted work that I do. I mean, this has been an amazing, amazing creative year, powerful and emotional, because while directing Paradise and working on that, either going there with the teams or working in the editing room, I was also directing an adaptation of Hillbilly Elegy for Netflix, which you know, deals with this microcosm of society, a similar microcosm of society and culture in America that I really, really relate to. And I understand this is my family. These are my, you know, near relatives and my wife's as well. And so it's been a you know, creatively really interesting. And definitely these two projects fed off of each other. But I would say that my scripted work with Hillbilly was more informed by what I was learning by being in Paradise, talking to these people. And you know, when you're making a verite film, you have this responsibility to probe. And so I'm not a professional interviewer, but I'm in these situations, and you have to dig a little deeper. It's a little uncomfortable for a guy like me, but it's not exactly my nature. But you know, you're asking police officers and firefighters, do you think we could use your body cam footage? Because I'm watching it from the fire, and it's so personal and emotional, and you hear them break down.
Yes.
I mean, they're human. They're in the middle of a nightmare, and it's hitting them too, and their homes are burning. A very unique circumstance, dramatically, mm-hmm. and pretty jaw-dropping to visit shortly after. But again, there's this long tail of struggle that is, and they all talk about a kind of a, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome, mm-hmm. where it just keeps coming back. Mm-hmm. We tried to reflect that in the movie, mm-hmm. by occasionally going back to, you know, that cell phone fire footage, that their personal experience, to remind the audience that, you know, just 6 months ago, just 8 months ago, this is what they went through.
Well, I know this is a new style for you, but I have to say your goal was absolutely accomplished. Mm. I left this film, as Aaron said, we live in San Francisco. I left this film realizing that, you know, we care about them when it's happening. We're worried. And then 6 months later, a year later, life is still hard for them, and we slowly forget about it. So thank you for leaving, having me question how I deal with these crises and being empathetic to what they're dealing with.
Well, thank you. And on an individual level, you know, kind of everything starts with what you just said, how we deal with this, how I feel, how we all feel. And, you know, it's human nature, and we have to get on with our lives as well, just as they do. But it does beg that question, again, what would we hope for? What you know, from our society, from our town, from our government, and clearly there's a level of anticipation that I think that we have to accept that is needed, right? Mm-hmm. And so for whatever reason, there's just a greater incidence. There've always been horrible fires, always been horrible earthquakes and sure, but it's intensifying as our population grows, and so we have to understand and be, I think, more aware, because the human suffering left in the wake of these things is scarring. You know, yeah. It's not just a bad week.
Yes,
mm-hmm. It's scarring, and as a nation, and as a culture, I think we have to recognize that and see what we, you know, and see what we can do. I'm not a policymaker, or an expert on the subject, but as a citizen having witnessed this, you know, this is what makes me think.
Well, again, the film is Rebuilding Paradise. It gives you a front row seat to both the beginning and the reconstruction of an entire town. It's an amazing film we've had with us, Ron Howard. Ron, it's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
it. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
The Festival Daily Buzz is brought to you in partnership with GoTo Productions. You can find more info at gotoproductions.com. That's go-toproductions.com.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, here with my Bitch Talk teammate, Angela Tabora. And we have two films that we're going to talk to our directors right now. We have from the Sundance World Cinema Documentary Competition, Once Upon a Time in Venezuela. We have Annabella Rodriguez-Rios from that film. And then from Slam Dance, we have the film Maxima, and we have that director, Claudia Sparrow. Welcome.
Thank you.
Gracias.
Okay, now, you know, and we start the segments letting our directors introduce our audience to our films. So, Annabella, why don't you start and tell us about Once Upon a Time in Venezuela?
Well, Once Upon a Time in Venezuela takes place in a little village called Congo Mirador, which is built on top of Maracaibo Lake waters. And from this lake, we extract our oil from. And what we did was to spend 7 years filming families there. Mm. And the story is that this place is becoming a swamp. People are needing the help of government. But because of the polarization, really, there's lots of tension. So then we ended up with a movie that has a really close human inside on the effects that a totalitarian system can have in the social network. Yeah.
From oil in Venezuela, we go to gold in Peru. So, Claudia, tell us about Maxima.
Sure. Maxima tells the story of environmental activist Maxima Cunha. She's a 2016 Goldman Environmental Prize award winner. And she is standing up to defend her land and the water, which the lives of hundreds of thousands of people depend on in Peru. And she's standing against the largest gold producer in the world, which is U.S.-based Newmont Mining Corporation.
What I love about both of these films is there are very strong, powerful women at the helms of both of these films. Can you each speak to how you met your subjects and came upon this story? We can start with you, Annabelle, with Miss Tamara and Natalie, the teacher.
Yeah. Well, back in 2013, when we entered the village, we began to work with Natalie, the only teacher of this small village. And there was a natural relationship with her. Actually, her daughter is my goddaughter nowadays, so then we really got close together. Mm. And I was really not allowed in Tamara's house for 3 years or something. Because we were together with these opposition people, right? Mm. And we are like labeled as in Spanish called squalidos, like the ones that has no flavor, right? Mm. And then we were squalidos and not allowed there, but there was a point when we needed where to stay because the one that was our host moved his house to another village, as you're gonna see in the film. People move their houses as they have to migrate. And we proposed Tamara a business. And as she's a businesswoman, before anything, the color of the money, I think it changed. However, trespass this first moment, I would say that we are friends nowadays, you know, after spending, 3 years going to her house, sleeping in the same space. Mm-hmm. So that's how it evolved, pretty much.
And Claudia, Angela and I are on the Maxima fan club. Talk about Maxima.
Thank you. It's a growing movement. We're very thankful for that. So I am Peruvian. I had been living in the U.S. for many years, and I had no idea that Maxima existed, that this was happening in Peru, that a transnational company was doing this kind of abuse. And so in 2016, when she won the Goldman Environmental Prize, a Peruvian journalist wrote a beautiful piece about her. And I was like so moved. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't sleep thinking of her. And I had never done a documentary before, but I thought, I'm a filmmaker, I have to be able to do something. So originally I thought, I'll do just a short something to create awareness. After months of trying to get a hold of her, because she lives 14,000 feet on the Andes in Peru, there's like no running water, no electricity. She cannot even read or write. So it's, you know, it really took us a while to get a hold of her, let us go meet her. And when I got there, I just saw like, oh my God, this is a much more bigger story. And the legal case was unfolding. So we just started rolling and we didn't stop.
Well, you know, one thing that, that these films share are that we're talking about activism, and we're talking about filming a process that never seems to end, because you'll have victories. Right. And then those victories will be taken away, and then you have more victories. So it'd be great for both of you to comment about that, on the process of the documentary filmmaker, like going, will this ever end? Will my film ever have an end to it? Right. And or is this part one? Like, you know, how am I going to frame it? So Annabelle, I'll start with you on this.
Well, imagine I was filming 7 years, you know, so then when to end? It was more like, there is a moment, I think it's a life that tells you, you know, you have a kid, you have to finish this one day and move on. We have to make a movie. But on the other hand, you are going to see it when you attend the screenings. The village ends up, I better don't say it because it's a spoiler, but there is a point when it was just not, there. It was not possible no more to be there. Mm-hmm. Still, it's like, as a storyteller, it's like there is a point when one abandons. It's not that I wanted to finish, that I felt, okay, this is ready. One just like has to let go. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that's actually very painful.
Mm-hmm. To, yeah. I think that was one of the goals with the film. We knew that there wouldn't be a clear ending per se in this journey. And I think the film, you know, hopefully it portrays that, like what it takes for an activist who is, for a woman who has not really no major financial, she cannot really fight with this transnational company, and yet all that she gets to get, all the fights that she gets to win, and the ups and downs of that journey. And I think it really represents the challenges that any activist around the world goes through just to defend resources that we all need to survive. It's pretty mind-blowing, really.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And even, you know, politics aside, what I love about both of these films is you do a really great job of showing the beauty of their lifestyle. Right. You know, obviously as Americans, it's something that we can't really relate to. But one of my favorite scenes, for example, is when Maxima goes into the city and she's like, what? They don't even see the sky at night? Like, wait, they live so close to each other, you know? Right. And she's like, how do they get the water from this faucet? You know, and she's just like, she can't fathom living there. Whereas we can't imagine how she lives, and the same with the floating village. You know, they're this quality of life of like laying in their hammocks and just enjoying the peacefulness and conversations with each other over what we're used to. Like, I think that both films do a really great job of expressing that beauty and defining different types of happy, what it means to be happy.
Yeah, it's true. Right. It's true. And this actually affects one as a human being, isn't it? Changes one's own perspective on possibly this question, what is happiness, you know, and how am I leading my life, and all these things. Yeah,
and definitely I think things that we take for granted, like sometimes we tend to think like, oh, these stories are happening so far away, it doesn't really affect me. No, it's your water, it's your land. Like, what are we really going to do when we don't have those? Like, nothing else matters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's unfortunately happening. And we just hopefully activists like them inspire us to do anything we can to do our part.
I'd love for both of you also to talk about the moments of excitement of filming. And Claudia, in your case, you know, you have great footage of some skirmishes, some face-offs between, you know, the police and military forces and the village. And Annabelle, you actually capture a bribe in motion, you know, on screen.
In floating motion.
So let's talk about that. You know, your feelings as filmmakers when you have those cameras rolling. You know, there has to be a little thing of, oh, I cannot believe I'm getting this on camera. You know, in those moments.
Without getting excited and shaking like, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god.
So talk about Annabelle and on that one in particular. Like you're going, this is actually. I'm getting footage of this actually happening.
Oh, yes. Well, no, in that moment, there was no much. In that particular moment, there was no much thinking, I would say. It's like one is just there, Actually, there is a whole crew, director of photography, sound. So there is a whole crew behind, just still. You know, like that. But in many occasions, we damaged some footage because exactly that, no? Because you are there and you're like, and then it's like, it's unusable because you are not really like concentrated. But this act of being really connected with the person in front of the camera is really magic. It's really like you're holding to the energy of this person, and then it's like you are floating, falling, connected to the center of this person. This is, in such a moment, there's not much thinking, really.
And Claudia, in your case, I mean, those are scenes where, as you're watching them, you also have a little bit of your mind like going, this could be dangerous. This could go very wrong very quickly.
Yes, because she lives, where she's located is so isolated, and she's basically surrounded by mine guards, by my security, Peruvian police. At all times, that was the concern. They could just walk in and really take our footage, and there was nowhere to run, nowhere to hide, really. So I think at night it was when it got trickiest, because there is black, pitch black, and we just had to be always aware of that and make sure we had backups of footage. I have to say that being a woman filmmaker helped me. I don't think that they really thought I was shooting. They thought that, you know, we used just equipment that was very small, so it just looked like maybe we were taking pictures. So I think that really helped in helping us be able to follow her around a lot.
Well, again, you know, we have two films here that wonderfully combine issues in two different countries with a very human element and female heroes like you've never seen. Once Upon a Time in Venezuela, we've had our director Annabella Rodriguez Rios, and from The Maxima, we've had Claudia Sparrow. It's been wonderful talking to you both.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you guys for having Thank us here.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz. I'm your host, Angela Tabora, joined by my co-host, Erin Lim. And right now we're talking about 1,000 Cuts. We're sitting here with Ramona Diaz, filmmaker, and Ruby Ibarra, musician. Thank you so much for being here, ladies. We are delighted to talk about this film.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
So I'm going to go ahead and start with you, Ramona. Can you please tell us a little bit about 1,000 Cuts?
So 1,000 Cuts is really a look at the Philippines under President Duterte at this time, through the backdrop of the midterm elections, and specifically through the point of view of one journalist who is speaking out against Duterte, Maria Ressa. And so we look at the drug war through the prism of disinformation and press freedom.
Sounds a lot like a country I know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Sounds very familiar.
Yeah, the parallels are uncanny. But how did you meet Maria and learn about Rappler and get into this?
I knew I wanted to do a film about Duterte and the drug war because, like, in 2016, I started seeing all these horrific photos on my Facebook page. And, there were photos I couldn't turn away from, right? I mean, I've built a career on telling Filipino and Filipino-American stories. So it was one thing that I was being drawn to. So I had this idea of making this film about Duterte and the drug war, not really knowing what it was. So I was on the ground in Manila in, like, mid-2018, and I met a lot of opposition and people in his inner circle, just trying to figure out how to tell the story. And I thought, you know, I should really talk to journalists. And the loudest voice against Duterte at that time was Rappler and Maria Ressa. So one thing led to another, I met her. And actually, I have a funny story about that. If we have time, I can tell you later. But okay. We met her. And then one thing led to another. And, you know, access takes time in documentary, especially the kinds of documentaries I do. They're very immersive, So you have to stay a long time. Presence is key. Mm-hmm. But she gave us full access in the end. Yeah.
And you just mentioned Facebook, and I was really struck by the numbers of social media users in the Philippines. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, for 3 years running now, we Filipinos spend the most time on social media, like 10 hours a day, which is crazy. It is a social media country. Well, we were at the texting capital before texting ever became a thing. I remember visiting in, what was it, the late 90s? And everyone was texting. I had no idea what it was.
Like, on their flip phone?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, this was before everyone, right. Before everyone was texting. Before the aughts, so yeah, before the 2000s. And they were also good at it with those small keyboards. You know, like, where you had to press 5 times to get to what you want.
T9.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. So they've always been ahead. And I think it's... has to do with a national character. We hate saying no. So texting is perfect, right? Because you don't even have to reply, right? We're non-confrontational. So social media's great. Texting's great. So it really, really aligns with the national character. I'm not surprised.
I'm just laughing because my two teammates here are Filipina. So you have totally...
Isn't that true?
Yes. Thank you for... Yes.
She could probably admit that's exactly what you just described is how she deals with the two of us.
Yeah. You hit the nail on the passive-aggressive head. Yeah. So, Ruby, I want to get you in on the conversation. How did you get involved with this project?
I was honored to receive an email from their team one day, and they were asking if... I think they were initially looking at one of my music that I had produced prior from my previous album. And as the conversation continued around, you know, making this music for this specific film, I think it might have been Ramona's idea to bring up, why don't we create something original specifically for this documentary? And, you know, we were in a very tight time frame. Mind you, this was also during the holidays. But at the same time, just me being such a big fan of Maria's work and also having just recently learning about Ramona's work as well. So kind of a side story, I met Ramona and Maria in person for the first time when I was out in the Philippines. I actually had a chance to perform at the Rappler Studios last year in March.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And this was, I think, during the time where Maria had just gotten arrested again. And me and my band were unaware that she was actually already released. So we were in the middle of filming our performance, and then in walks in Maria into the office. And then I'm just there trying to keep my composure and remembering my lyrics. I'm like, oh my God, it's Maria Arisu just walked into the room.
She's a superhero.
And for me, she definitely is an icon. She's a superhero. And what I love about her and Ramona, too, is that they're both Pinays who are fearless in the work that they do. And I think that very much aligns with my values and also my artistry. So when it came to the opportunity of creating an original song for this movie, of course I had to say yes, and I wanted to be a part of it in any chance that I could.
And it totally makes sense. I mean, Ange and I know who you are, but I think the audience is listening doesn't know who you are. So happy that you were brought on board for this film. It makes total sense. So
it was an honor.
It was great.
Yeah, I have to say, I've never been so excited to wait for the credits. I'm like, what's the song? Let me hear it. It's so good. This is like the perfect marriage.
But you don't understand. We were all like crazy trying to get through the finish line, right? And this idea of creating an original song at like the 12th hour. But she just jumped in. She's like, sure. I'm like, okay, here's the film. We sent her a link. And the first thing she sent back, we were like all blown away. I mean, she totally got it the first time. There were a few things, you know, tweaks here and there. But for the most part, it's what she has submitted for the very first time. It's just great. It's amazing.
It's the premise of the doc. Strong women make things happen.
There you go.
I mean, this Rappler is not backed by any big business. It's run by women.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about the filming of this because, you know, Maria puts herself right on the front lines. So did you or your crew ever feel threatened or any certain way by following her and just kind of like, all right, make the sign of the cross and jump in?
Basically that. Right? I mean, there's a scene in the film where... Maria's talking to her sister, right? At one of the hotel scene, and Maria's saying, you know, you just figure it out and you just do it, right? If you're good with it, you do it. I think that's how I felt. Like, if I had thought about it too much, I think fear would have gotten the better of me. But I think that in years to come, I would have regretted not doing this. I'm a documentary filmmaker. If I shied away from this, I think the big regret, it would have been. So the imagined regret was stronger than the fear at that moment. So I just did. I knew it was the right thing to do. My concern was the local crew had to stay behind, right? So we had to have that conversation. We are leaving after the shoot. You're staying. Yeah. It's perfectly okay if you don't want to still be involved, right? I mean, we gave them a way out, and each and every one of them stayed. They said, no, this is the right story to tell, and we should tell it. This was amazing, yeah.
And the gut punch of hearing the war on drugs again, I was like, this was already done in the U.S., and it didn't work. So can you talk about that through line, too, in the film?
Yeah, the drug war, you know, candidate Duterte, right, when he was running for president, he promised the drug war. He promised that he would get each and every drug pusher, drug kill, every, you know, that was, he ran on that, right? And he made good on his promise. But no one, I think, ever really understood that it was extrajudicial killings, right? He was going to, basically the police is like allowed to go out and without any due process, gun down alleged, right, drug users and drug killers and drug pushers.
The poor,
yeah. And they're extrajudicial because they don't go through the due process. But the narrative of the police is that they fight back, you know, but forensics show that they don't have the means to fight back. The police are armed, right? They're running away. So a lot of them are shot the back. They're not fighting back, right? They're running away. So, it's horrific. The numbers are like 27,000 extrajudicial killings, according to human rights groups.
And before this film, I saw the film The Kingmaker.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there was obvious planting of evidence on film, which was insane. So, yeah, thank you for capturing all of that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about, and I'm glad that you bring this up in the film. You know, I have some family members in the Philippines, and I asked them, like, how do you feel about Duterte? You know, because obviously it's horrible. We face this with our own president pretty much down to the T. I mean, the nepotism, the fake news, like, basically they're running from the same rule book. And my family members there, as you spoke to in the film, were like, well, you know, it doesn't affect me, and, you know, there's less. And I'm just like, wait, what do you mean? And you speak to that. So thank you for talking about that and how that's, you know, that's a dangerous way of thinking.
Yeah, because I think the numbers are so horrific. I mean, they're so high, right? 27,000. It boggles the imagination. I think at some point that you have to stop thinking about it to live in the country, right? But then on the other hand, You can't afford to turn your eyes away because they will be coming for everyone, right? Where is the line that, you know, they'll never stop, right? Now it's the drug pushers and drug dealers. They were talking about, you know, and then he went after the tanbais, the loiterers. People couldn't loiter. But if you look at the neighborhoods, those neighborhoods, like, encourage you to just, you know, you're sitting on the stoop because it's hot inside. So, yeah, so where does it stop? They don't think of impunity, right? Once you give the government, like, a means to kill and not question it, it doesn't stop.
And I think that Ruby, I think you're a great spokeswoman for what's happening in the Philippines and spreading your message and being socially conscious in your music, and I really appreciate that. So can you talk about your process of, like, what's happening there and trying to bring it out here and making it mainstream?
I think with every work that I do with my music, I understand that as an artist, just like as a director or, you know, a filmmaker, the work that you put out, it's on a larger platform, and you're not essentially, once the product is out, you're not just speaking for yourself, you're also going to be influencing others. So when I do talk about what's going on in the Philippines, I try to do, you know, careful research on it and make sure that what I'm saying is not only positive but also unfiltered and unbiased, like not just having my opinions but realistic to what's actually going on. And with a lot of the work that I do too, I also am mindful that, you know, as a Filipino American, a lot of people, especially in my age group and within my generation, we don't really have that connection anymore to the homeland. And I want to make sure that, you know, it's important that what's going on over there is very real and we should care about, and we should know about what's going on over there, because it directly affects us. And it's like what you guys have been mentioning in this conversation. It's aligned with what's going on in this country as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being here again. We've been speaking to Ramona Diaz and Ruby Ibarra of A Thousand Cuts. It's really been an honor. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for so having us.
Thank you.
It's great. Thank you.
And that's a wrap on today's edition of the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This show is made possible with partnerships with the Slam Dance Film Festival, GoTo Productions, and KCPW Radio. In-kind donations are provided by Pro Bar, Keto's Brewing, and The Market, Park City. Our audio producer is Charlene Godo. Social media help was provided by Shoshana Howard. And assisting us in production are Chris Gardner and Brian Silverman. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan. Thanks for listening.